have called, you have, you're listening to the right, you tune into the right station, Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network. I was just trying to make sure a couple of our special guests are in the studio, and we have Karen Seneferu joining us to talk about her wonderful exhibit, The Black Woman is God. Good morning, Karen. How are you?
Good morning, Wanda. I'm doing very well. It's a beautiful day to talk about The Black Woman is God.
Oh, every day is a great day to
That's
talk
right.
about that.
That's right.
Yeah. We were listening to Sina Molly, Sina Denny, and we are continuing our celebration of women. And let me tell you a little bit about Karen Seneferu. This wonderful exhibit is actually in two parts. The part that's at Sargent Johnson Gallery is up through May 30th, so you're going to have a nice long span of time to be able to visit and revisit and sit in the gallery and just contemplate this wonderful exhibit that, gosh, Karen, how many artists are in this particular exhibit? It's huge.
20 artists.
20.
Yes, 20 artists. And I'm really looking forward to next year where certainly there'll be more artists. There's so many incredible artists in the Bay Area. 20 was just the limit we could do within the space that we were in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be great if you could get the Hall of Humanity upstairs. Then you could
really
spread out. Mm-hmm.
And even onto the other side of the Bay as well, you know, have it where it's not only in San Francisco but in Oakland at the same time. So that's really what I'm looking for, you know, to create that cross-cultural and cross-Bay Area connection.
Right. Wow. And I didn't even realize that you were a self-taught artist. Grew up in Oakland, California, received your BA in English from the University of California at Berkeley. And you're interested in how individuals can be a part of mainstream society and maintain cultural integrity. And your day job, you are a teacher. Yeah, in your academic hat, you've created a program that removes fear and anxiety for foundational learners or students called Take Flight at Berkeley City College, where you have been quite a while. You teach there as well as Laney College. Is your Take Flight at Laney or is it just at Berkeley City?
It was a pilot project that was located at Berkeley City College.
Okay. Oh, so pilot meaning that your funding ended and it's no longer there?
Yes, and, you know, I actually moved. I've been moving artistically and intellectually in and out of the academic world and the art world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as I shift from one place and do my magic, then I move into another space. And so it was very difficult to maintain that project. That project is like a baby that needs constant care. And so, too, is, you know, creating art and then, you know, for my first time curating an art exhibit the AAACC. Yeah, so.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, because I remember, because I know you were in the first show that we had for the Ma'afa commemoration. And you had your wonderful altar because I saw it at Pro Arts when it was on 9th. And, yeah, that goes way back. And you had a, it was just a wonderful installation. And you hadn't gotten into the Nkinsi space that you always have now in your various sculptures. But it was just fantastic. And so it was like the centerpiece of the gallery, like right in the middle.
Yes, that was I really appreciate the opportunity to do that too, Wanda. That was, I think, the third time I had ever exhibited. When you asked if I would restructure that particular piece of the African continent with slabs of marble and pennies and pictures and candles, and, you know, just really showing the connection between the personal and the political.
Mm-hmm.
And the second place where I exhibited at, which was at Pro Arts.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually among 600 people from Northern California to enter into the contest.
Mm-hmm.
And out of the 400, I was one of 60 to win, to get in it. And then I was I came into second place out of 60. And when the judges came in and seen that I had created that installation, they were so angry at me because they said, you should have diagrammed it. You should have let us know that you were going to do this because we would have given you first place. And really, for me,
wow.
these installations came out of nowhere. They didn't come out of, one, me knowing that they were called installations, or two, knowing that they were also within our own African diaspora called altars.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, I couldn't have my artwork in blank white space. That really was the inception of these kind of altar-like pieces,
mm-hmm.
that I just couldn't have them standing alone in what, for me, was blank space.
Right. Wow. Wow. That is amazing. Yeah. And I'm continuing along in your bio, because I want to get to that part that talks about transforming the meaning of space. Space on the paper, space in the gallery, right? Space in your person, like transforming it, claiming it, and naming it yourself. at the center of this program that was taking too much of your life, so now it happened, and those lucky students that were a part of it, you know, have been transformed and able to continue on and share that what that they learned about writing and narrative, which you talk about, that narrative is art and art is narrative, and how your teaching and your art are not separate. Actually, they, you know, thematically and with regards to your philosophy, overlap one another, because you talk about how every space, which, you know, space, you know, as a teacher, you know, space as an artist, space as a person of diaspora, space as a political sort of mechanism for a lot of things, has potential for creative output, education, and healing, you're right. And in other words, space dictates meaning. What enters that space is dictated by the meaning of that space, or can transform the meaning of space. And you use various mediums. You have, like, become the installation woman. Like, oh, doesn't hang on well.
I love the piece.
Yeah, well, you know that piece that you had when we did that wonderful First Friday tour with Dwayne Ditterville, you know, wonderful
yes.
scholar brother. Did he get hired? Is he full time somewhere?
I hope so. He needs to be. People need him.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was applying for a position in Peralta, you know, our collective family. Yeah, yeah. He'd be such a gift to the district.
Yes.
You know, hopefully, you know, whoever gets him would share him with other places. But, you know, that exhibit that you and your wonderful husband, you're just such a creative team. It was a gallery that was downtown Oakland, and you had this, one of your installations, and there were, it was a different kind of installation, and I don't know if there were lights, because sometimes you have, like, you're connected to, your pieces are connected to electricity, and they have lights, and they have think boxes you can open, and they're kind of interactive. Sometimes they're really tall, and sometimes they're, you know, not taller than regular, you know, or short people like me. You know, we can see over them. So what was the name of that piece that you were telling me about? And then you know, you're the celebrity, because it was, you know, artist reception, so everybody was, like, trying to get your attention. But you gave me a few minutes to talk about it, and it was just so interesting.
Oh, wow. I'm trying to think. Was that at Joyce Gordon's gallery?
No. It was
Coles
at
Road?
It was at the new gallery I'd never been to, right there next. It was this beautiful big space. And what was that? And it was a sister owns it.
Betty Ono.
Yes.
Yeah, Nika Barker's space. Yes, 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 yes. Yeah, I mean, that was when I did an exhibition with my husband for the first time, you know, where we showed together as a couple. That exhibit was called What is Buried is Not Lost, and was really a very powerful space because of how large it is, and also just the idea of establishing art pieces, Malika and myself establishing art pieces that are about portals and doorways and creating access to other worlds and other ways of being in the world, while at the same time being in the public arena. I mean, for me, what's really important is to figure out how to bring the private to the public, how to transform spaces from the mundane or the file to sacred. And so I'm always moving into spaces, whether it's at a museum or a gallery or a community space or a classroom, to turn those spaces into sacred areas, so that because of the history of the Black body in public, that's really at the center of what I'm doing. For me, exhibition spaces in particular have been designed historically with the intention of demeaning the Black body, the Black presence, and the value of Black culture, our African culture. Mm-hmm. And so anytime I'm given an opportunity, and particularly at the Betty Olmos Gallery, where the walls were just so large, and Anika was so generous in her willingness to allow for Malik and I to explore how we wanted to dialogue with each other around portals and doorways and sacredness mm-hmm. and memorial.
Right, yeah. Why don't you tell us what you mean by sacred? Because, you know, your narrative and your values, one sees, you know, one knows, you know, Karen Seneferu's work, then, you know, no matter if there's just 20 pieces in the gallery or one, we can go directly to, we know the ones that you have assembled because they just have, you know, this. And also, I was just thinking, you know, you're real statuesque and regal in your person. And so that comes through as well, you know, the way you carry yourself.
I appreciate that.
And the way you look. I mean, you look like a queen. You know, when you and, you know, Malik and Seneferu step out, it's like, oh, my goodness. Your royalty is stepping up, you know. And I'm sure.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm sure you know that sort of transforms the presentation of like whatever people are bringing to you. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's sort of like whatever their intention is sort of snatched right away and correct it before it comes before you, just because of the way, you know, that energy that surrounds you. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that sacredness and that space and talk a bit about the Black woman as God and what you and Melora have created for us.
Mm. Wow. Well, for me, the sacredness of the Black woman is the recognition of reclaiming the bodies you know, in order to transform community. I think it's really necessary for Black women, for Black community in general, and the Black woman in particular, to reclaim the body, because that was what was taken, and so much of the value of who we are is embedded. The spirit is embedded in the body, so and it's not in one particular location of the body, but it's the body itself. So what does that mean in terms of art? Well, bringing in a body of work from various artists who on the one hand are emerging artists, and on the other hand, you know, like artists such as Stargate, what's this young woman's name? Just incredible, does this incredible mystical kind of work, like huge mural forms, and also does this kind of engraved copper piece with wood, say Stargate. She's only like 21, but I just know that she's a rising star in the Bay Area art scene. And then having someone like Dana King, who just retired in November 2012, to become or reclaim herself as artist. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean as a Black woman? Well, the very act of creating is a God-like activity. Mm-hmm. And attempting not just to create, to show something beautiful, which is, I think, essential to Black people, but to show how beauty is a transformative element. And so there's artists in there like Blue Wade, who has this 3D photographic imagery of that looks like trees, looks like branches, or looks like a sketching. It's hard to determine what it is, but it looks like nature, but it's you know, it's that in, movement between recognizing something that's familiar but not being able to clearly identify what that transformative imagery is. And so in some ways, reflecting that is the mirror of the self. And so I think that Black women are at the center of that. And certainly the biological representation of the Black woman being the only one that has that holds the mitochondria of all of the human race is an indication of the power and the value that she has in the world that for me has to be recognized. And taking these concepts of the body of sacred, the Black woman being the creator of the human race, and not just discussing it among ourselves, but putting it out there within the community, and having individuals who may not be a reflection of the community, but it recognizes the importance of art and its voice, I think is essential, because the space that has a public element to it can become transformed with the intention, and the intention is reflected in the kinds of work that are in that, in the exhibit, The Black Woman is God. So it's not just simply a place to come in and to look at art and to intellectualize art, but to come away with some understanding of the value that the Black woman has to the human race, the value of the act of creating as a Black woman, the value of connecting public space to the sacredness of what it is to be in the world, and then to have the society to acknowledge that. You know, that I think is if society could acknowledge that the Black woman gave birth to the human race, then that says a lot culturally, politically, socially, and as opposed to, oh, the Black woman is simply a body to be used, to be manipulated, to be devalued, and those kinds of things. So that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, talk to us a little bit about you know, your background and art and its role in your, like, how did a Karen Seneferu come into being? You know, talk about, you know, sort of like your family and the women in your life and how you were able to take this bold step in the kind of philosophical thinking that makes, you know, the work you do so profound and so affirming for Black women, for people in general.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I think it's a cross-section of a number of things. You know, one, I come from a family where I'm the fifth of six, and every single one of them has either been in prison or a mental institution. And for me, both of those are mental institutions. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on the perspective, the mental institution that I chose was the academy. And so, whether I'm, you know, teaching around the idea of identity through language, or teaching around the idea of identity in art, I still see these cross-sectionings between these two places as mental institutions, in some ways no similar to, but in some ways different from the ones that my brother and sisters have struggled in their lives to identify the value of who they are. And so I think early on, and I don't know to what extent I was conscious of it, but early on I knew that there was a necessity to claim myself in public. That was really, really important for me, even as a young girl. And by the time I became a Berkeley student, I had cut off all my hair and was wrapping my body and wearing necklaces and things like that, and really wanting to adorn myself with an African aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't comfortable. It wasn't I wasn't acknowledged and valued in the way in which I thought the community would in embracing myself. It was actually the complete opposite of that. And because of that, I recognized as I was moving in and out of my community into Berkeley or the university itself, that the reason why my community didn't value this physical representation of beauty that I thought was because of the place that I was going into to get the information to transform myself on some intellectual level. And just that alone made me being physically in the world a form of resistance. And then I met my husband. and my husband just put, you know, he put extra layers on it. You know, Malik Sinefru, when I met him, the first thing he said to me was he was an artist. And he called himself the artist, Malik Sinefru. and really transformed my way of moving, made me recognize that actually what I was doing physically in the world was a form of art, and that I was claiming my physical presence in the ways in which I was doing, that was a form of art, and that I just needed to translate that to a different medium. And so initially I started with these soft figurative pieces that were made out of beans and rice and beads, attempting to show that there was no distinction between the staples used that created nourishment within the community, beans and rice and things like that, and then beads as an aesthetic form, and just exploring what that means to integrate those two different elements, organic and inorganic elements. Mm-hmm. And so it just developed from there. You know, I kept getting opportunities to create, and usually what would happen is that it wasn't that I had created a large body of work, but that when people would see the work, they would say, so could you create something for this exhibit? And then I had to go, yeah. And so I'd create something, and I wouldn't actually live with it. It would actually live more out of the house than it did in the house. And that's happened, I would say, for about 5 or 6 years now. And I was attempting after this opening, I was like, okay, no more of that. This year is going to be different. I'm not exhibiting anymore for a year. I'm just going to stay at home and create and see what develops. But, you know, the universe is like, nope, that's not happening. So, you know, I have some upcoming, I'm really excited about these upcoming exhibits that'll be at the end of March and April.
Tell us about it.
No, I don't want to talk about it yet.
Not yet? Okay. So, how was it working, with Melora? She's produced some really wonderful exhibitions at the African American Art and Culture Complex, Sergeant Johnson Gallery, as well as the Hall of Humanity upstairs, where there's a current exhibit that's celebrating our elders.
Yes. Well, Melora Green and her sister Melanie Green are just dynamic sisters. They're twins, and really has taken San Francisco by storm. Melora Green is one of the coordinators, if not the artistic coordinator at the AAACC, and it's just been a wonderful experience. She really has galvanized me into doing this exhibition, because we were just having a conversation about the challenges of what it is to be a Black woman, and then I just said, oh, well, you know, the reason why we can move through certain elements is that the Black woman is God. And she says, that's the name of the show. And I'm like, what show? The show you're going to curate. And I really thank her for pushing me into the curatorial position and exploring what it is to both try to wrangle 20 artists. As my girlfriend says, it's like putting cats in a box. I'm trying to wrangle 20 artists to come in and create and to write about themselves and to establish the value of themselves in this particular way, and to also have them discuss, with the help of Idris Hassan as well, who documented the discussion around this topic for the artists that are in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just really, Melora is just a wonderful person. She's very young, but she's doing dynamic work, and she's creating enormous opportunities for artists, for Black women, for elders, for emerging, for well-established artists. to have a platform to convey the ideas and values that you know various artists hold in their work. And so I'm just very fortunate to have her in my life, and I really look forward to working with her some more. Her and her sister, just their dynamic. They're called the dynamic duo because they're just they're wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I'm having a really great show this morning because following our discussion, we're going to have Zaina Carlotta Pearl Allen on the air to talk about her work, which is in at least two exhibits, one at the Joyce Gordon Gallery, her celebration that she always has for Women's History Month, and then Transformative Visions, which just opened last weekend, the One Life Institute annual exhibition that actually had a year off, and now it's back, you know, with a bang. So great to see both you and Malik in the audience last week at the concert, which was so wonderful. But I wanted to ask you, in closing, if we could talk a little bit about the magic that you bring into your work and the magic of you know, the element in Nkisi that is just so mystical and just so sort of, there's such a charge in that particular aspect of your work. You know, you talked about doors and openings and things like that. Could you talk a bit about the Nkisi? Because that's a real African, but it's also African emblem, sort of, is at the heart of so much. And we see it when we look at how indigenous African culture shows up in the diaspora. You know, we look at what's going on, you know, with people that are, you know, or voodoo and people that are other types, but voodoo in particular, you see the Nkisi, you see it, you know, in the various drawings, you know, out of sand. You know, we look at the mandalas from you know, Haiti. And so anyway, if you could talk a little bit about that, that'd be
wow,
so cool.
Thank you. I appreciate you establishing the foundation for it. That was very piercing for me. Well, the Nkisi is a wooden sculpture that's called that is seen as a power force because it holds in the center of the sculptural piece a box, a closed box that has a mirror on the outside, and inside that box are elements that are only privy to the creator or for whom the piece is created for. So there's all kinds of hidden properties that are in there that creates the power force. And in some ways, that box is really the navel of the piece. And the piece can have a number of purposes, but one of the purposes that for me is at the center of what I do is the intention to resolve conflict. And so the wooden piece oftentimes has nails on it, and it'll have these little sacks or balls or sashes or charms. And again, inside it, it has medicine or some hidden elements and materials that help to transform the challenges and the conditions in the community or individual desires for help that the sculpture was created for or the individual was created for. And so I wanted to figure out how I could both pay homage or dialogue with this very ancient form of sculpting and creating and healing, and at the same time give it a futuristic or contemporary element to it. And so I looked at the physical aesthetic of the piece, of my pieces. So that might be, you know, I like to use found objects, so I'll take paper lanterns and I'll cover the entire exterior of the piece with mud and clay and dirt and paint and give it almost like a wall, like texture to it, and then put familiar iconography drawings and image and symbols on it. And then, of course, it has to have some kind of head that, for me, looks like it's been dug up from the ground, like it's just to see if it's been excavated, but not stolen. And the piece has a both kind of crusted exterior with a face that's present but not quite clear in form. Also, it has an interior. So it does have the box, but the box has a video inside, or the box has an opening where you can see photographs inside with one of my pieces called Suns Heal Your Spirit. So technology becomes in some ways the communicator. It's not necessarily the center, although it is the center. I don't want it to be the power force, although it draws individuals to it. But it's really balancing between how technology is so central to our everyday way in which we communicate. But then what is the message? What is, and how does that message become reflected in what people look at when they see the videos or listen to the music or the, you know, in one piece I have people laughing, and the people that are laughing in that piece act is based upon a documentary that I did with Idris Hassan on Giving Me Lip, where people were interviewed about nonverbal forms of communication. So I took the laughing track out of that and put it against these videos of children and mothers and boys and young girls in the Congo Basin and struggling against the violence that exists there. So you get this really kind of, you know, wonderful elevated laughter from Giving Me Lip, but that's being juxtaposed against these images and really trying to create a transformative relationship of the individual who came in to look at the piece. You can't just simply look at the piece, but you have to engage with the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then this newest piece that I've done, what I did was I took excerpts from different videos on YouTube where, you know, various scholars and laymen, particularly black men, talking about the value of the black woman as God, but juxtaposing the passion and compassion of the voices of those individuals against images of black people being hung from trees, and particularly a black woman being hung from a tree. And while you're looking at that image, you hear this black man saying, this is what is sacred. This is what is sacred. And yet the very act of the black body being desecrated in this way shows to what extent we are so far from that recognition and value. So that particular piece actually has the video in the hands of the sculptural piece. So it's almost, and it's designed in such a way that when you come up and listen to it, and you have to plug in to listen to it, meaning through earphones, that you're actually looking inside the hands of the sculptural priestess in prayer. So, and then you also have to, you know, kneel on it in order to engage with it. So I'm attempting to, through the forms, through this organic and non-organic, through technology, through ancient, through kneeling, through prayer position, and linking the individual to the piece so that you're not just simply looking at the piece, but you're actually tied in and tuned into the piece, that it'll create some shift. And I've heard, you know, from different people when they experience it this way, a number of people said they couldn't listen to it all the way. They couldn't listen to it all the way in public because it was too... it was going to create something for them in public that they didn't feel safe in that environment to do. And that's not what I want people to come away with, but although that element is important as well. But what it reveals to me is that the piece is doing its purpose.
Right, yeah.
It is creating transformation.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, gosh, Karen, we have to have you on again. This is just so fascinating when you can talk about what's coming up as well. And,
okay.
And you know, this wonderful piece that you created for this exhibition on the Black Woman as God, you know, within itself, I mean, your pieces sometimes are larger than you know, they're bigger than just the normal person. So this one here she's statuesque, and then Kesey is actually in sort of the center where life is conceived. So it's kind of interesting, you know, the placement of the Nkisi this time, which is sort of like a transformation of, you know, and also sort of looking at the way the black woman and the black body is portrayed. So you're sort of like flipping that, you know, as opposed to, you know, the rape. You know, this is the nurturing and the reverence, right? So
yes,
maybe that's why you placed it there, but I don't know.
I like that. I like that.
Okay, and I like her caller. You know, she looked like she's calling on some of the folks, you know, down in Southern California or, you know, not Southern California, Southern Africa, you know, with the collar, and it looks like the underbelly, you know, because she's just really, really beautifully ornamented. I don't know if you know Zaina. Do you know Zaina?
Zaina, yes.
Yeah.
Zaina,
okay.
Zaina,
yeah.
Yes, that she's a I saw her work after the exhibit was up, and I was heartbroken, but because her piece is so beautiful in transformative visions, it's such an incredibly beautiful. I remember seeing her posted at 1 o'clock in the morning. I was up at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was just blown away. I was just looking at it. I said, how big is this? I wanted to see the details up close. It's a beautiful, Zane, it's a beautiful, beautiful piece.
Thank you so much.
I can't say it. I think I told you a lot of that. I'm not going to say it anymore.
I know.
It's a beautiful piece. And thank you. Thank you for creating that. And I hope to have that in the exhibit next year.
Well, thank you
so
much, Karen, for joining us, and we're going to shift over and talk to Zaina in our you know, remaining 20 minutes or so, and looking forward to finding out more about where you're going to be popping up, and hopefully maybe you'll have another artist, some kind of, you know, I mean, I know you had like a big opening, but maybe you have an artist talk since the exhibit's going to be up for such a nice long time.
Yes, there's something coming up. I'm working with Melora on that now. It'll definitely be in April, and I hope the community comes out for it. And I really like your idea about perhaps doing two artist talks because there's so many artists in it. So, and thank you for creating the space for us, Wanda, to be able to come on and to talk about our work and to talk about how, despite the challenges that we have in the world, that we're still moving and creating and transforming.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. You have a good rest of the day.
Thank you. You too.
Peace out.
Thank you, Karen.
So, Zaina, Carlotta, what a beautiful name. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm great. Thank you so much. It was so amazing listening to Karen.
Yeah, well, we have cut into your time, so we'll have to have you on again. But now in our remaining minutes, we're going to talk about how another self-trained artist, like, oh, my goodness, all these women who are just, like, just picking up the brush, picking up the camera, you know, just you know, creating these wonderful pieces. Your work is just so, every piece is on your website. Your website is great.
thank you.
Yeah, your work is just so beautiful. You know, photography, your mixed media pieces, which are so, gosh, the layers, you just want to just like, wow, what's under that, and how did that get there? And then your other pieces, your drawings are just, oh, my. I said, okay, which one do I want to buy? Okay, I like the one about red.
Oh, wow, they're all for
sale. I like
sale.
The one given. Yeah, oh, I know, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, we definitely want to. William Rose talks about how we need to collect our work, right? So, you know, definitely want to be a collector.
Wow.
Yeah, certainly.
That sounds beautiful.
Thank you so much
for having me on.
Yeah, so you're a self-trained artist who uses the mediums of collage, painting, sculpture, and installation in your art, which is currently a part of a number of exhibitions at the Joyce Gordon Gallery, which we already mentioned in Oakland. And you have an artist talk coming up next month. When is that?
I do. I believe it's on April 5th from 6 to 8. I'm not sure within that time period when I'll be speaking, but between the hours of 6 to 8 p.m.
Okay, excellent, excellent. And could you give us the address for the George Gordon Gallery? I know it's on 14th Street. Do you have the address handy?
I can pull it up right now.
Yeah, I think it's like 410, but I'm not certain. I haven't said it in a while. But it's right below Broadway. And
it's 406 14th Street, Oakland 94612.
Okay, excellent, excellent. And how long is that exhibit up, you know, celebrating?
That is up until April 27th, and I know that this month they added about six new women artists to what was premiered last month during First Friday.
Growing.
Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah. And then what Karen was mentioning, you've got lovely work in the Transformative Visions exhibition, which is a part of the One Life Institute exhibition that happens every year. And as I mentioned, missed it during 2012. Had to go fundraise a little bit. But it's back with a bang, and you are in it. I believe you have, what, three or four pieces?
I think, yeah, I have four pieces in it.
Right, yeah, and they're for sale. You even insured
them. They are all for sale.
Yeah, and they're like, one piece is just like huge. You can just sort of step into it and just be in that scene.
Yeah,
it's just so, so wonderful. And your work explores, as you write, universal themes of matriarchy, cultural knowledge, and preservation. That are cross-culture in their significance. Your subjects are often women, relatives, and indigenous deities of the African and Asian diaspora. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your art making and your travels. And you're also a musician. You play the kora.
I do play the kora. I also picked up the ukulele recently. And,
nice.
The guitar as well, yeah.
And the guitar as well?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Excellent, excellent.
Just to mix it up a little bit.
Okay, yeah, well, ukulele, that's nice. Yeah, so let us know when you're going to be performing, too, if you have any gigs.
Yeah, definitely. I'm kind of in hibernation mode a little bit with creating, but as soon as I'm ready to come out, I will let you know.
Okay.
Yeah, so I guess in answer to your question, you know, I can't say that I know exactly, like, where my art comes from, and I don't necessarily try to trace the source of it, like where the ideas or like the inspiration come from. They just come.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, the biggest foundation is, you know, my mom is an anthropologist. And so I think coming from that background and the kind of just like cultural education that I was given growing up has had a huge impact on how I perceive myself and just the amount of respect and compassion and love and appreciation I have for other cultures. When I was 16, my mom, it was either to go live in Chile for a year with a family. I ended up just going to Mexico for the summer and like in studying about Mayan culture. And she sent me off by myself with like a group of college students. It's completely crazy, but you know, having that kind of foundation, you know, and being to interact with people, like indigenous people, you know, in the workforce in terms of, you know, their food, their music, and how they live their lives just really gave me, you know, just a huge level of love, you know, and an understanding of how important it is to connect to other cultures and to connect to my own culture, you know, which was also given to me growing up. Yeah, I think initially, you know, I started making art again about 3 years ago, and I hadn't done it in over 10 years, since I was probably like in my early teens.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure exactly what happened during that time period, but I think Karen was saying it's kind of like, you know, you were in a cocoon, you know, when I was explaining to her that process. But when I came out of that, I had been working at the Craft and Folk Art Museum in Los Angeles, and I'd seen this exhibit. Yeah, I was interning there for a semester, and I had seen this exhibit of Mithila art, which is this form of drawing and painting that are done by women in Nepal and India.
Mm.
And, you know, it's generally ceremonial. It used to just be done on walls and on floors, and they kind of transferred this tradition to paper as a way of making money and being able to generate income for their communities. And seeing that, I was completely struck, and it was this kind of two-dimensional, you know, form, like very very imaginative. You know, humans can have animal bodies, like, you know, and 10 hands, and nothing has to be, like, linear. And for me, as somebody that didn't really know how to draw and hasn't really taken, you know, formal art classes, you know, since I was a little girl, it was a great space to create because there were no boundaries. It didn't have to look realistic. It didn't have to, you know, I didn't have any, like, in terms of, like, depth perception, like, things didn't have to, like, come to the forefront or be in the back. Like, I could just kind of be all over the place. And that's kind of, you know, really where, and looking at the subjects that they explored, and since it's a form of art that was done by women, it, you know, it explored the themes that, you know, are relevant to women in that particular area in India and Nepal. So you're looking at, you know, infant mortality and marriage and women's rights, you know, just kind of, and then, you know, just cultural knowledge. So, like, you know, it could be in food and, you know, and like in collecting herbs, you know, there's so many different topics. And I think, you know, starting, that was really my foundation for getting back into drawing. And mm-hmm. so I think that laid the foundation for kind of everything that I began to create, you know. And then also just being, you know, I was raised by a, you know, a Black feminist woman who's also an anthropologist. And so, mm-hmm. you know, all of these things kind of seep into my art, not intentionally, you know, but unconsciously I began to create what I know. And, yeah, and so that's the beginning of it.
Yeah, wow, that just sounds really great. You know, you have a choice to either spend a year in Chile or your mother sends you to Mexico. That's
yeah.
Awesome. Really awesome, yeah. And in your bio, you write about how you're, you know, really inspired by your personal research of folklore, oral histories, and the iconic imagery you encountered while living in East and West Africa as a teacher and student, respectively. And it was there, I believe, that you learned about the storytelling tradition of the Jalia as a mm-hmm. choral player. And I know in your work, even if we can't unpack it all because it's so deep and rich in the iconography, in the imagery, mm-hmm. I was trying to say icon and make it into another form, but I can't figure out how to pronounce it right at the moment. But, you know, we know when we see these eyes and these you know, these other symbols that, you know, like, we need to talk to the artist, just, you know, if we don't have the information. Or we can just enjoy it, but we know, like, wow, we could really enjoy it if we knew more about what this symbol mm-hmm. means. What if you could talk about that, because you've got some wonderful work. And then, you know, photographs of, you know, from East Africa. But I know mm-hmm. it's showing up in the drawings as well. And yeah. then you have pictures of your trip to Haiti, and I don't know when you were there. Mm-hmm. Why don't you talk a little bit about sort of like how, you know, your life experiences have impacted your work and the various mediums you create in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, gosh, I think for me, like I said, you know, kind of coming from a space where I didn't know that if I could draw or if I could make art or, like, what exactly I could do, like, not having formal training. Before that came, what came first were the ideas and the stories. And a lot of that was instilled in me. You know, I've been playing Kora for about 6 years, and I have an amazing teacher in Los Angeles who's really like a father to me. His name is Baba, and he has a website, Baba the Storyteller. And
nice.
And so for me, it was interesting because before he let me, I had come from playing guitar, and I was really interested in blues music and started studying, like, you know, some pre-electric blues. And then when I moved to the Kora, it was interesting because the rhythm patterns and the bass patterns, like, that you have to play on the strings are exactly the same. And so I was really, like, I was fascinated by that, but it was interesting because before he would teach me any song, you know, before I could touch the instrument, I had to learn the story first. Mm. And that was key for him. He's like, I'm not gonna, you know, teach you and have you going around telling people that I'm teaching you and you don't know the history behind the song that you're playing, or you can't explain to them what it's about. So this is what we have to start with. And it's the same thing, you know, with art. Before I know what, you know, what medium I'm going to use or how I'm even going to do it, because sometimes I sit down and I'm like, I don't know if I necessarily have the tools for this. Like, I have this image in my mind and I have this story that I want to convey, and I don't necessarily know how I'm going to do it, but the story is very clear. And so, yeah, that has really transcended, you know, from, you know, my that the musical space, you know, of my life into the, like, the visual art space, mm-hmm. And having that as a foundation. And I think what's interesting for me is, you know, I really think about the art that I create and the music that I create as, I kind of think of art as like a visual ethnography. And I think about how it contains so much information. And so, you know, I think the question that you had sent to me or you had mentioned is like, you know, what happens when art is absent in our life, or what's the importance of it? Why should, you know, and I think about it, it's like, well, why should people care, you know, that we create these things? And I think about it on a few different levels, and I think about how art can contain information. It can contain information about how to live, what works in a society, and it's this kind of visual mapping of, you know, how to connect with your ancestors, how to, you know, it could be how to prepare certain dishes, you know, and all of these things can be recorded, and you can look in different cultures, and whether it's, you know, petroglyphs, like, you know, carved in the side of a mountain, or their sculptures, or their, you know, their paintings, and even within music, you know, these stories, you know, kind of, they transcend, you know, like the visual arts and, you know, and the musical arts, and they're even communicated in dance. And so it's really, for me, just kind of drawing upon these, you know, these stories that exist. And I think what's really important for me as well is, like, is telling these stories. It's one, it's a personal meditation for me about how to, you know, how to reconnect with my own ancestral past. How do I understand where my family has come from, you know, and their ancestors? What do they do? And, you know, and even just trying to connect to a higher power, or, you know, or to the earth, you know, whatever it may be, how do I do that? And I believe that art and music and dance all contain, you know, these kind of, these really interesting clues about how to do that. And I think that that's what I'm trying to recreate, or not even not recreate, because it's already created. I'm trying to draw upon that same tradition in, you know, in what I create. And, yeah, I mean, I spent 8 months in Ethiopia teaching English, and I spent time in Gambia. When I first started studying Kora, I went there for 2 months, you know, during the summer. And it was interesting. Yeah, I mean, I didn't spend that much time playing Kora. It was more about the experience, because it was my first time on the continent, and
okay.
It was rough.
Oh, was it?
You know? Oh, yeah.
What do you mean by that?
It was a very humbling experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you mean it was rough? You mean coming from this Western paradigm and it being a very different place, Africa, when we think about California or other places you had lived prior to your first time on the continent?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, I had traveled around the world by myself before then, and nothing had prepared me for what I would experience there. One, I had never been in an all, you know, black country before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's like there's so many things that came up in terms of how I perceive myself, how what I think how other people perceive me. And I think what it was is it helped me shed a lot of layers about who I think I am. And I didn't process that all when I was there. It took a few years, you know, of experience after that to really understand what was the point of some of the things that I encountered while I was there. But it was incredibly humbling. I experienced some adversity, and at the same time, I experienced a level of generosity that I'd never really seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was.
Yeah.
It was a great experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did they grow you on the inside? Could you talk about how you construct material spaces that offer a place of reprieve from mechanized culture? And within these arenas, mm-hmm. deities and traditions can interact with the physical world. By doing so, you write, I create a place of refuge for myself and others to consider our ancestral past and reconnect to our present cultural identity. And then I also noticed that you are part of Ebony's African Nation Artist Organization.
I am. I'm on the board of that.
Right, yeah. And I came to I came to the celebration at a dance studio on Grand. Where the artists were there.
I do remember that. I was there.
Yeah, and the artists were sharing who they were connecting with. Artists here in the Bay Area were talking about the artists that they were in conversation with artistically, like in Ethiopia. And I thought that was so cool. So talking about both those things, I'm just asking you the question about with regards to your the question was like really great and nice. It went off a little bit, I was asking you about sort of connecting, this travel and the space to how that has shown up in your own work, you know, insofar as this construction of this space that offers a place of reprieve. So you're just coming back to drawings and to your visual arts for the first time in 13 years. You write. As of 2010, and just wondering about sort of that creating space, because we talked about how, I mean, you do a lot of things, you know, you're a musician, you tell stories, through your music, and then you even surf, you know, like, whoa, like how many people,
I'm learning to surf. A friend of mine is taking me out to Pacifica around 10.
That was so awesome, like, you know, like being open to surfing, like, wow. I mean, it was a great exhibit down in the Southern California, which you probably checked out. It was about African-Americans and, you know, and Africans and that surfing tradition. Mm-hmm. I mean, we live on the coast, you know, we're around the ocean. Of course we're surfing, right?
yeah, there's a great, I think it's the Black Surfers Association in L.A.,
yeah.
I had connected with a little bit when I was wanting to learn when I lived there. I think for me, the intention behind the work that I create, especially with the mixed media, because generally what I do is I take images when I make paintings or I'm using photos for collages, is I take images of Indigenous women from all over the world, you know, so it could be Algeria or Gambia, it could be, you know, an American Indian woman, you know, here in the States. And I recently found a picture, this beautiful picture of an Eskimo woman, you know, and so for me, my intention is really to restore them to their rightful place, which is, you know, being these cultural matriarchs and the preserver of traditions and the holder of wisdom and of tremendous beauty. And so I really think about how, and that's why they're the subject of the work that I create. Now, whether nobody sees them, whether, you know, they end up on my walls or they end up in, you know, in institutions, in museums or in art spaces, it's important for me to consider how to create a level of reverence for them, you know? And so I think that's why that's why they're the subject of the work that I create. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm walking into my apartment for a second. Yeah, and so that's why they're the subject of the work that I create, because I really want to, I really want to create a space for them to be acknowledged, you know. And so I start with myself, you know, and that is, how can I acknowledge these women? How can I acknowledge their struggle? How can I acknowledge their accomplishments? And then inviting others to do the same, you know. And now whether it's my ancestors that, you know, that I'm making, you know, pictures of or sculptures of, or people go home and do the same for their own ancestors. You know, it's really an invitation for everybody to look to their past, to look to, you know, the people that helped create you know, their families or their cultures, and kind of using their struggle and their accomplishments as roadmaps, you know, and as, you know, as understanding for how to live our own life.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it's been really lovely speaking to you and looking forward to your artist talk. And when were you in Haiti?
I was in Haiti, gosh, I was trying to look at, I think for my picture that I put 2012, I believe it was,
okay,
it was last May, March, April.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was last March or April.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I believe that was 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for,
No, I was going to ask you what took you there.
You know, I was there for 2 weeks. My uncle, he gave me an opportunity. He, you know, he said he would take care of my food and my hotel if I wanted to come.
Okay.
I just needed to get there.
Uh-huh.
And so I took him up on it. He's an artist as well, and he had been there several times, you know, during the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me and his daughter. And I think he explained it to me because I was like, well, what brings people, you know, what brings people here? And he just thought, you know, just culturally, it was important for us to go and, you know, to be able to see and experience, you know, what Haiti is about. And it's really interesting because when you step off the plane, there's not many, when I was on the plane, it was a lot of missionaries, mostly missionaries, you know, who were not, you know, not African or African American. And when I get off the plane, you know, the first question people ask me is, you know, like, you know, what church am I with? What organization am I with? Because they couldn't understand why I would come, you know, maybe why I would come to visit if I wasn't a missionary or I wasn't on some sort of, you know. And then my answer was always like, you know, I want to come see how my people are living. Like, you know, I want to see what's happening in this country. And
right.
And it's not good what is happening in that country. You know, politically, and well, not necessarily politically, but economically, and in terms of the, you know, the presence of the nonprofits, and it was pretty devastating. It's in a lot of, you know, in terms of the state of the earth, and you know, there's a lot of devastation there still.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, enjoy your is it your first lesson?
Huh?
Is it your first lesson, your first surfing lesson?
Oh, no, you know, I've been a couple of times, but I think
you're a surfer.
My third.
Oh.
No, I'm still learning how to stand up, but yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I'll
well,
be meeting my friend for that.
Right. Well, have a wonderful time surfing, and thank
great.
You so much
thank
for this
you.
Wonderful conversation.
Thank
people should visit
you so
your
much
website.
For having me.
Yeah, so
oh, yeah.
Zena Allen, her website is ZENALLEN.com. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's wonderful work on her website, of the different mediums that she works in, and hopefully she'll, you know, put some clips from her musical performances so we can listen.
Yeah, those will be coming soon.
Yeah,
those will be coming
yeah.
soon. Well, thank
yeah,
you so much, Wanda, for having me.
Oh, certainly, certainly. And we don't want to miss your artist talk during the hours of 6 and 8 on April 5th
mm-hmm.
at the Joyce Gordon Gallery, 406 14th
yeah.
Street in Oakland, downtown Oakland. And Transformative Visions is up for a bit. It will be
yeah.
at the Studio One Galleries through April. Looking for the closing date.
I believe it's April 8th.
April
8th, 8th or 9th.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Eighth or ninth, yeah. So that's a nice,
yeah.
nice opportunity to get by and look at the wonderful work. And
yeah, there's some amazing things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, there's some beautiful things up.
Well, we'll have to have you on again.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful day.
You too. Peace and blessings.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. Good morning. How are you? Is this Valina?
Yes. Hi.
Hi, good. Glad to have you joining us again after last week didn't work out. I'm so happy that you were able to fit us in your schedule to talk about this wonderful piece that you're in, A Lady and a Woman at Theater Rhinoceros, which is closing, unfortunately, this weekend. How has the run been for you?
Oh, well, we've been having a really great time doing this show. I agree with you. It's a really unique and beautiful piece, and it's really been fun to do and share.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You're Miss Flora, independent woman, owns her own boarding house hotel, and you know, just, gosh, she has such great stories behind that apron of hers. Yeah, and then we have Biddy, you know, comes in, you know, as one of her boarders, portrayed by Don L. Troop, and the two of you all just have such great energy, you know, synergy together, and the beautiful songs that you sing as, you know, you're getting to know each other, and all the sort of domestic things that happen, you know, when people live together. And this particular period is just fantastic. So first thing I would do is I'm going to introduce you properly. And it was great seeing you on Monday as a part of the play reading series at the Magic Theater. That was a pleasant surprise seeing you as a part of Christine Anderson's latest work, Penmanship.
Yeah.
And then the audience conversations afterwards, that was pretty interesting, huh?
Mm-hmm. Very, very.
Yeah. So let me find, here's your bio. You are an award-winning actress that people should know because you're famous. Yeah, I mean, people who love theater have had a wonderful opportunity to see you in quite a few productions, particularly on the Mime Troupe, San Francisco Mime Troupe circuit, because you are one of their resident artists, and you a singer, a songwriter, and a director whose artistic home for several years, as we mentioned, has been the San Francisco Mime Troupe. You perform regularly at several Bay Area theater companies, including American Conservatory Theater, Berkeley Repertory Theater, the Magic Theater, Theater Work, Shogun Players, San Francisco, or SF Playhouse. They have a new home, really beautiful space, formerly occupied by the Lorraine Hansberry Theater on Post Street. I want to congratulate them on that. It's always good to have, you know, a nice house, you know, to be able to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And the Denver Theater Center, among many others. Your film and television appearances include Party of Five, Nash Bridges, Trauma, Final Witness, B Season, Maladaptive, One Way to Valhalla.
Yeah, Valhalla.
Valhalla. And Milk. Valina is also a coach and writes a monthly column for Theater Bay Area magazine called The Business of Showbiz. And I just want to just salute you for that wonderful work. What's it called? Jonestown?
The People's Temple.
The People's Temple, yeah. That was, my goodness, if you never did anything else, that was like, wow. You know,
yeah, that was a...
Mm-hmm.
That was an amazing piece to work on. Quite, you know, it was a writing team headed by Lee Fondakowski, who also directed. Margot Hall was one of the writers.
Mm-hmm.
Coleman Domingo was part of that team. And, it was very intense, moving, sort of, I think everybody was definitely changed when they came through that process of working on that piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was so good to tell that story because it happened. You know, these people, they lived here.
Yes.
And now they're buried here, you know, in this mass grave. So it's sort of like to excavate those stories and to breathe life in these people that, I mean, that was a whole lot of people. That was like almost 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And so them, they just can't just disappear without a murmur, you know?
Yeah.
It was just really fantastic. One fantastic piece of theater and writing and that process that, you know, I heard, you know, about you all just sort of getting together and just, you know, doing all this research and then shaping these characters and then portraying them too on stage. Like, wow.
Yeah, that was interesting. It was also interesting to do that and also be in Milk because those two tragedies happened within a couple of weeks of each other.
Really?
And yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so that time period in 1978 was really tough for San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. So, So are you a San Francisco native?
Well, I've been here since I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't born and raised here, but I've been here a long time now.
Yeah, so where do you hail from?
Well, I was born in Staten Island, New York.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's kind of a blip in a way because my dad was in the military. So, you know, before I was two, we moved to Germany where my sister was born. You know, and so New York, Germany, Texas, Alabama, Maryland, you know, kind of all over before ending up out here.
Oh, yes. You have a nice feel for the country.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about Miss Flora and her backstory and you know, and sort of how you came to this particular character in Shirlene Holmes, A Lady and a Woman, which you know, takes place at a time in history when, you know, sort of, you know, who you could love and how you could love was not necessarily, it was one that was more socially, a social construct. And these two women, you know, they love one another. They, you know, they found each other and then sort of they created a life for themselves that they didn't have necessarily any models for. And that, you know, took a lot of courage.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really interesting, there's so many things that are interesting about this piece because, pardon me, as I mentioned earlier, it's not a story that you've seen 100 times. Like there are certain, you know, stories that get done over and over again in one form or another. And this one's unique. And it is set in a time that it's the late 1890s, so it's, you know, about 30, 35 years after the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment pass. So Miss Flora was alive during slavery. And Biddy may or may not have been. We're not, you know, just based on what the description is of the characters, where Miss Flora is 40-something and Biddy's 30-something.
Mm-hmm.
So very close to slavery. And these two women in such close proximity to that time period are independent business women. Which is interesting,
mm-hmm.
You know, that Miss Flora owns her own, she owns, and see, when you said boarding house, my Miss Flora wanted to correct you and say, no, this ain't no boarding house, this is an inn.
Oh,
it's
sorry.
A respectable place now. And so, yes, she's very particular about how people perceive what it is that she's doing. It's not, mm-hmm. It's certainly not any kind of a brothel kind of juke joint kind of, and then boarding house would be a little better, but no, this is an inn.
Okay.
And she runs it. Whereas Biddy, she is a skilled laborer, you know, who she's itinerant in that she moves around. She's a traveling butcher. And there are no women doing that work, but it's a very sought after skill. She's very good at it, and so they each earn their own money. They each have created their own way of you know, making a living and taking care of themselves. And they were doing okay, you know, in that sense, in terms of their independence, in terms of their financial independence, they kind of had that down. But it was more in their life otherwise that Biddy was getting a little bit tired, actually, of the traveling around and never really having a home. And Miss Flora, because of her background that had been some very painful experiences in her background, and one of them shows very clearly this scar that runs down one side of her face. She pretty much assumed that in terms of a personal romantic sort of thing, that wasn't happening, you know. She'd only had really horrible, bad experiences with men. One when she was a child, and then the one when she, her ex, now ex-husband, hit her, and she ended up falling into the wall mirror and getting this huge cut in her face. Mm-hmm. So that's over, and so she pretty much figured that aspect of her life was over and done, and she had accepted that. She wasn't pining about that at all, really. But she's been lonely. She, you know, so people know her in the town as someone who runs an inn, and also as she's a midwife, she's a healer, herbalist, and so she is someone that people come to for during some of the hardest moments of their lives, during emergencies and you know, things like that. So she's kind of, you know, a bit of an authority figure as well. But there isn't anybody who's close to her. There isn't anybody at, in the end of the day that she can just, phew, you know, just relax and talk about her day and you know, share just special, fun moments with. There wasn't anybody. And then Biddy comes bursting into her life and everything gets kind of turned upside down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really wonderful watching your character navigate sort of, because she's, you know, she is a well-respected woman in the community, and she cares about what people think about her, and so she struggles with that, and she's also a really religious woman. I mean, mm-hmm. she is, you know, she believes in God, and she belongs to a church, and you know, like you mentioned, you know, she is a pillar in the community as a businesswoman as well as a healer, and she's sort of squashed, you know, self gratification in something, you know, that she might do just for herself, like she's the only one that's going to benefit, not necessarily society. So then, when Biddy comes, you know, into the inn, just sort of like a breath of fresh air, and sort of opens up her to these villains, you know, and these places that she has, like, shut down, closed the door, locked it with a, you know, a deadbolt. I'm like, oh my goodness, it's so cool. And even though, you know, there are a union of two women, one can certainly identify with this relationship, even if one is not a woman who loves other women.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's bigger than that.
Yeah. One of the things that's really you know, fun about Shirlene's writing in the piece is that it's, you know, the process of them coming together, being very independent and figuring out a way to fit together, where in which no person is giving up who they are,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so that's you know, a moment where when Biddy kind of has a big jealousy moment, that's the place where the two of them have to really sort of define the sort of the rules of engagement, you know, and get really clear about, you know, okay, we're together, but we don't belong to each other, we belong with each other,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that. When that gets sorted out, it's really a great moment for them, you know, because then Biddy can kind of relax and realize that Miss Flora, you know, loves her, but is still going to be who she is in the world,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right. Yeah.
So that whole thing of her religion, she's very, very spiritual. Her connection to spirit is very direct, mm-hmm. you know, and it guides her in everything she does. And so when she has this relationship that starts budding with Biddy, that's where she gets a little bit disoriented, because how does this fit in, you know, is what she's trying to figure out. But I find it that fascinating and really great how she's so sensitive to her alignment with her spirit, her connection with spirit. And that's what enables her to really tune in and figure out what to do to help people and to, you know, make decisions that spirit tells her how to respond in emergencies and stuff. So keeping that channel open is really, really important to her. And so someone else sort of saying, well, look, you have to do things according to how what's going to make me more comfortable. And she's like, you know, I love you very much, but my connection to spirit is going to remain unbroken. Mm-hmm. So anything that could obstruct that is not happening. I just need that to be clear, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing is what she, and so I think it's really beautiful because it's not that they're not, it makes their relationship more resilient. Because, you know, the reality is most people, you know, they go like, oh, there's the infatuation period, and they're so into someone, and they start contorting and twisting themselves into a pretzel to fit in with them and to be pleasing to them, and they hide aspects of themselves, and they're pretending that they're into things that they're really not into. And then the energy for all that faking just runs out, all of a sudden it's like, I never liked this, and oh, you get on my nerves, you know, like all this crap that's been stuffed down starts pouring out, and then the relationship is destroyed, you know. Whereas if you can be real up front from the beginning, the relationship is definitely stronger and more flexible. So that's one of the things that feels really good about this relationship with these women, is you feel like they're going to be able to weather a lot of different storms because they're being real mm-hmm. with each other.
Right. Yeah. I was wondering what attracted you to Miss Flora, and were there any difficulties with her character as you began to put her on and sort of breathe life into this entity and make her, you know, someone that, you know, we would care about and that we would be interested in knowing. Were there any difficulties, and how is this particular character similar or different from other characters you played, or is she strictly, is she unique, or do you see each? I'm giving you all these questions. Sorry.
Yeah, there's several in there.
or do you approach, and I was just thinking as I asked you the question, maybe you might approach each situation and each character as a new person, so that there really isn't another, similar to the way parents say that, you know, each one of my children is unique, of course, and you know, they are whole within themselves, and so, you know, there might be some family traits because, you know, we're all a part of the same family and there's the same socialization. So, but, you know, so-and-so is, you know, completely autonomous being from so-and-so, their sibling or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the first question, when you said what attracted me to Miss Flora, well, the thing is that I, in terms of the casting,
yeah,
When John Fisher, the director of the piece, and also artistic director of Theater Rhino, when he contacted me about auditioning for A Lady and a Woman, I said, well, could you send me a script? And he sent me a script, and I read it. And at the time, I didn't know for sure which character he was interested in seeing me read, or if it was, if he wanted to see me read both and decide, or if he had an idea. And it turned out that he saw me as Miss Flora from the beginning. But in terms of the description of the character, the both characters that Charlene had put into the script, I kind of straddled both of them, you know, in that Miss Flora is tall, whereas Biddy is actually supposed to be described by Charlene extremely short. She says like 4'8". Now that's going to be hard to cast.
Very short.
You know, so, you know, actually, so that was one of the things. Visually, she had Miss Flora as being 6 feet tall, and Biddy 4'8". Well, that's not the case in this. You know, in fact, that would be really hard, like I said, really hard to cast. I'm like 5'9½", and Dawn is like 5'8". So we're both on the tall side, but neither of us 6 feet tall. And, you know, and then Biddy talks about being dark. And, you know, I have dark skin, and, you know, Dawn's sort of dark. I mean, like, you know, we both are very, actually, we're both kind of similar in type physically, you know, like no one's super, super light skin and nobody's super, super tall or short. You know, we're kind of in the same, you know, in a similar space. And so, so when I was reading the script, I was kind of thinking, well, maybe, you know, and like my hair is actually really very short, you know, very short, natural. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, maybe when he sees me, he'll think, oh, maybe she's more Biddy. So I was kind of looking at both of them. I wanted to be prepared for both. But, you know, but John the whole time really saw me as Miss Flora. And so it was like, okay, cool. And so as I started really focusing in on her, I think I could, you know, relate to her being a person who likes things a certain way, you know, doesn't like to have a lot of, you know, shocking, surprising things happening all, you know, because she deals with helping people in emergencies. So she deals with that on a certain level. So in her own home, in her own space, she likes things organized. She likes things clean. She likes things clear, you know, like I could just sort of really relate to that, like wanting order, you know, and I just, that was a way, definitely a way in with her. And also really her being a very sensitive person and, you know, trying to maintain her own connection with her inner source and power. I can relate to that. You know, so like you find the way that I work in terms of creating a character, connecting with the character, is just, you know, we all have access to all of the different feelings that exist. You sort of alluded to earlier about being all part of the human family. Even if you're playing a character that is you know, someone recently was writing about like the school shootings. Well, there's so many school shootings. Which one? The guy his last name is Lanza, and he shot all those kindergartners, kind of thing. Like if someone was to make a movie about that, the task of the actor playing that character, it's like if you say, well, that's just horrible, and that's something that I would never ever do. Okay, of course not, but you know, there is a way in to figuring out how to play that character anyway, even if it's not like you know. So you find where the connections are and you build on those, and then you start to you know, then you just start to use your imagination to fill in everything else. So you can, you know, you can get there. Mm-hmm. And but Miss Flora is not super far away from me in the way that, you know, playing a character like that school shooter would be, you know. Did I just confuse you?
No, not at all. No, I could follow you. I liked your analogy with regards to how, you know, as an actor, you are not the character, but sometimes the characters that you portray do come, you know, some of the values that they have do overlap your own, and what I would think that would make it an even tighter connection, but you don't have to have any values that overlap for you to make an authentic connection with the character. And I was thinking that perhaps sometimes when you're making a connection with a character that whose values you're opposed to, you probably need to do some kind of magic and, you know, some kind of protection, spiritual protection for yourself so that you can separate, you know, after you do this thing, you can protect your spirit from the kind of energy that this character embodies, because this character is real because you're real. So, and that's how we're able to identify with, you know, you as an actress on the stage bringing us these stories. So I think that's pretty interesting as well. And then your character, she works spirit, you know,
mm-hmm.
and she works it on stage. I mean, you know, we have these moments, you know, where we are in ceremony, like seriously, and those are some really beautiful moments that your character sets up for us, as well as Biddy, because Biddy is new to this too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Biddy, it's what's fun about Biddy is that she's kind of more, because she's traveled around a lot more, she's seen a lot more, and she has really accepted her position as an outsider. You know, it's really, it's one thing to be a part of a community and have a certain image and reputation that you feel like you need to protect in some way, that you're concerned, that you could feel concerned about. And then it's another to be in a situation like Biddy, where she is so overtly unusual or peculiar, you know, in terms of how other folks, towns folks might see her,
mm-hmm.
that she's accepted that. You know, it's like, okay, I'm a stranger in town, and when people stare at strangers anyway, you know, even if they don't look unusual, but in Biddy's case, she, you know, she doesn't wear dresses and stuff like that. She wears work pants and kind of more men's clothing, and she does for a living something that women do not do, and you know, and she's just much more clear within herself that, okay, people are going to think I'm weird, but that's the way it is, and you know, I got to be me.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. And I was just thinking about the symbolism of, you know, Biddy is a butcher, and there's a lot of blood. And
mm-hmm.
blood is what, something that is, you know, blood is sort of like the afterbirth of ritual, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's you know, sort of looking at like blood, and that carries the life force, and yeah, it's just sort of looking at that as a symbol. And butchers, what do butchers do? And then the keeper of the inn, and you think about inns, and you think about sort of the history and sort of the mythology around inns and Christ, and, you know, and not having a place to have her baby, you know, Mary,
mm-hmm.
and then thinking about, you know, what the playwright told us and, you know, and the talk back, you know, when you all opened that weekend, it's sort of like where this story comes from. It's like, oh, this is like really heavy duty here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I was wondering about the ending. It doesn't. The play seems like it's open for a continued. Like, okay, let's like see what happens here.
Yeah, you know,
it has such a surprising twist at the end.
Oh yeah, you think of it as a twist. I think that different people have said stuff about that, and so I told Charlene. I wrote to Charlene about this because. There was a panel discussion after last Sunday's show with Jewel Gomez and Brian Freeman and Dawn and I, and there were some different people who said, "Yeah, I want to." One person said they really wanted to see a prequel of the story because they were very curious about like Biddy's life before coming to the inn, you know, and just how, you know, how did she navigate and negotiate being a woman by herself traveling between these different towns? Like, how did she do that? Because that's really unusual and kind of difficult, you know, you would imagine. So, you know, there are people who wanted to see how she became who she was by the time we meet her, and then other people said, well, we want to see a sequel, or we want to see the characters Biddy and Flora older now, that, you know, and they wanted to see what happened with Cora. They want to see baby Jesus, older and see some of the miracles that she's able to do, you know, and just like, and how this town has adjusted to this really amazing family.
Yeah.
So I told Charlene about that, and that tickled her. So we'll see, you know, that'd be interesting if she actually felt inspired by the interest in these characters to write either a prequel or a sequel or both.
Yeah, it would be interesting. Or, you know, we could just use our imaginations, because I think there's enough material there within the work for us to, with some sense of authenticity sort of project into the future with regards to this wonderful couple who show us how to love and how love is a great place to bring up baby Jesus. You know, and how, you know, it seemed like they were developing, you know, for this point to be able to do that. And
I mean, one of the things that makes me so happy about doing the piece really is that because it is an opportunity to see these two people make a life, and you don't really together. And you don't really get to see that very often. I mean, most of the time, the very few times that you would see lesbian characters, most of the time they're not in couples. They're singled out. They're isolated in some way. You know, they're not in a part of a couple most of the time. And then if people do, you know, you see that something, it goes wrong. There's tragedy. Someone, you know, like, and people said that all the time. They kept waiting for the inn to get burnt to the ground, or for one of them to get dragged out and beaten to death, or one of them to, you know, kill themselves. Like that this happens all the time with the lesbian characters, that they don't get to go ahead and have their happily ever after. We see the happily ever after, you know, all the time, but not with lesbian characters. And so it's like that's what makes me happy to, you know, like last night there was one of Dawn's students, because she's a teacher, and one of her students came to see the show. And afterwards, because I think she's maybe 14 or something, or 15, and she's a young lesbian girl, and it's tough, you know. I mean, those teen years are difficult anyway, and then if you know that you're gay, it's tricky. It's really hard. And so for her, it was very moving to come and see this piece and see these two characters make a life, you know, because so many kids, they just don't see anything that's encouraging, that says that you can have a life, and a lot of these kids are killing themselves, you know. And so, like, I wouldn't have been interested in doing the piece if it had been that, okay, and in the end, Miss Flora, you know, makes some herbal thing and drinks it and dies.
Mm-hmm.
Because she just can't. She just can't do this, you know, mm-hmm. that she's too worried about what other people think, that she just can't do it, even though she loves Biddy. So she writes her a beautiful note and does some ritual and kills herself. You know, like, I wouldn't be, you know, or if it was like, oh, well, then, you know, the townspeople beat them up or something, then I wouldn't want to be a part of putting that message out,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I think it's, I think at this point that's been done enough, and I think it's really dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, I certainly agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, we're speaking with Valena Brown about A Lady and a Woman, which is closing this weekend, darn, but you have an opportunity to see it three more times. So it's tonight, the 22nd, tomorrow the 23rd, and Sunday. Tonight and tomorrow there are the curtain is 8 o'clock, and the Sunday is a 3 p.m. matinee, and the shows are at the Eureka Theater, 215 Jackson Street between Front and Battery in San Francisco, and and they say it's, you know, walking distance from Embarcadero BART, but it's a long walk, so don't give yourself just 5 minutes, otherwise you will miss the curtain. Because that's what I
yeah.
And I was like walking and walking, like, where is it?
Yeah, it's at least a 10-minute walk, and if you're in heels or something, then 15.
Yeah, it's walkable, but it's not 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And you can visit www.therhino.org to get tickets, which are very reasonable, and or you can call area code 800-838-3006, and don't want to miss this. This is just really a fantastic performance with Valena Brown and Don L. Troop. They're just oh my goodness, just so great. It's just a beautiful, beautiful story. And Valena Brown as Miss Flora and Don as Biddy. They're just they sort of create a story, gives the story a life that the playwright has created, that you, under the direction of a wonderful director, that lives with you long after the curtain goes down. It's just really marvelous. The set is great. Your costumes are just so wonderful. The lighting is great. And then the songscape, you know, those spirituals that you and Don bring into the piece, which, you know, that's you doing that, right? I mean, that was something that was created here in San Francisco, right?
That's right. There are two references to songs, one that were in the script. One was Steal Away to Jesus, Shirlene mentions in the script. And then the Scrub and the Floor Blues, she had written the lyrics for, but there was no music. So I made up the, you know, I composed the music for that. It's basic, you know, blues, which was fun. And then all the other things, there was a certain point where John said, well, what if we did songs between the scene, you know, like to go with the scene changes. And so then we started just thinking about, and this was the very collaborative part of, you know, thinking about, well, what would be good to go here? You know, so someone's in the kitchen with Dinah, for example. I had, you know, brought up the idea because that song, the way that we're used to hearing it, that someone's in the kitchen with Dinah, like really bouncy and bright, and years before, I thought, well, what if you did that song totally differently, you know? What if you did, like, someone's in the kitchen with Don, you know, like, really kind of raunchy, you know?
Yeah, whole nother,
and I thought, well, that would be...
be a whole nother meaning.
Yeah, yeah. So what's going on in the kitchen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so so I thought of the sort of the slower way first of covering a change, going from the quilting into combing Biddy's hair, where, you know, she's screaming because I, you know, because I'm trying to comb the kitchen,
right.
You know? And she's like, ah! You know, so I thought that would be fun, and then it was like, well, why don't we do it the more traditional way when she's coming in bringing in the tea? Like, it was just sort of like these different ideas that just sort of brainstorming that came up that John was like, yeah, that sounds good. So yeah, it was really fun,
yeah.
Just, you know, finding the different pieces, and people have been enjoying it. And that was just kind of like a thing that happened, because singing was not part of the audition. He wasn't intending it to necessarily be thought of as a musical, and it's not a musical. It's a show that has music.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Have you and Don been on stage together before in anything?
Well, we had done a reading together. One of the last readings of Tanya Schaefer's The Fourth Messenger we had done together. And that was my first time meeting Don. And so we worked on that. It was like a week-long workshop going into two readings for that piece as Tanya was preparing to mount that show that just closed.
Oh, we missed
it. Yeah.
Where was it?
That it was at the Ashby stage.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that just closed last weekend, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but this was last year that Don and I first met and worked on that. So that was my first time. So it was nice to have met her and to have, you know, found her to be, you know, very talented and very nice. And so when we ended up doing a callback together for A Lady and a Woman, it was like, okay, I at least, you know, I know this person, you know, which was helpful. Because that was the other thing, you know, when John offered me the role of Miss Flora, I said, sure, great, who's playing Biddy? You know, which is a really important question. There's just the two of you.
Right.
You know, and you're working very, very closely together. So who's the other person? And he was like, oh, I'll let you know as soon as I know. And I'm like, ah, what am I agreeing to? Because that's a big part of the agreement is who am I working with?
Mm-hmm.
And I had felt like that she and I had the best reading together. But, you know, I didn't know if she was actually available or what was, you know, so it was kind of a mystery for months who I was going to actually be playing with.
Oh, wow. You didn't know for months. Wow.
Yeah.
A long time.
I know.
To not know that you have the role, but not knowing the other
person
who's going to be having the other central role.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, you were really patient, and I'm glad you didn't say, well, it's taking too long to find out. I think I'm going to do something else.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't take it anymore. Just this suspense.
Yeah.
Mhm. Wow. Yeah. Well, this again, once again, Valina, the show, A Lady and a Woman, is just really fantastic, and
thank you.
What you do with your character is just outstanding. You know, she is just phenomenal. You know, in your hands, and I hope you have a wonderful closing weekend.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, so I hope people take advantage of this rare opportunity to see this unique and very beautiful story.
Yeah, and where are you going to be showing up next? I was really pleasantly surprised Monday to see you at the San Francisco Jewish Community Center you know, reading in the role of narrator for Christina Anderson's latest play, Penmanship. So where are you going to be showing up next, besides in your regular column in the Theater Bay Area News magazine?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. In April, I'm going to be in Santa Cruz. I'm going to be doing a small concert there because I've started doing, my own show of music.
Yes.
And so I've done two in San Francisco so far, and I'm going to be doing another one April 21st. It's in Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it's kind of more of a, it's a house concert, you know. So it's possible if you have any Santa Cruz. Do you have Santa Cruz listeners? Do you know?
Oh, yes. And
okay.
Listeners around the world, yep.
Mm-hmm. I think, well, the way to find out about it if you wanted to come, mm-hmm. is to RSVP to come, is to go to my website.
Okay.
There should, to velinabrown.com. And get more information about that if you'd like to come. And that's going to be Sunday, April 21st. And in May, I'll be doing a performance for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Oh, nice, yeah.
And that's May 26th. But you know what? I actually don't know where we're doing it this year. But I've been performing with a group of amazing musicians for many years to honor the Abraham Lincoln Brigade vets and their families. Lots of beautiful music and poetry from that time period. So keep an eye out if you're interested in that. That'll be May 26th, but I wish I could tell you more. But you know what? What I want to say is that I have a feature article in this month's Theater Bay Area magazine about why it's time to bust out the F word, and the F word being feminism in theater.
Yeah.
And so it's in the March-April issue of Theater Bay Area magazine, and it's just recently been posted online on the TBA website. And I'm really happy with this piece in that, and it, you know, kind of gives a really great overview about a lot of work that's been done with women in theater. Do you remember the Lilith Theater Company?
No, I don't.
Yeah, they were started in the 70s. They're not around anymore, but there was, like, you know, just kind of going through and saying, you know, there was Lilith, and then Ellen Gavin started Brava, and Erin Merritt started Woman's Will, and, you know, and there's new things that are companies that have popped up, like Symmetry, that's really focused on having gender parity on stage, because that's really a problem in terms of, you know, there's so many plays where the casting, it's like six men and one woman, you know. And that kind of imbalance. So there are lots of really talented women who are left not getting to work very much, you know. And so so many, like the Guthrie Theater that did a 12-show season and not one woman playwright.
Really?
You know. So anyway, this is
a lot of theater, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I'm really happy with that piece, so I hope people will check it out. Why it's time to bust out the F word.
Yeah, what a great title. We have to maybe have you on again to talk about that after I read it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I'd love to.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. Oh, thanks for telling us about it. I didn't even know about the article, otherwise I would have read it in advance and we could have talked about it right now. Oh, excellent, excellent. So people want to, find out more about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade specifics, and they can just visit your website around that time, and it'll be up, right?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, cool, super. And it's really been great, you know, talking to you, for the closing hour, and thanks for staying with us. Dawn was trying to call in, and she was getting some kind of weird messages, so unfortunately she wasn't able to join you, but she was trying early at the top of the hour. But I was wondering if you could, just for our audiences that might not be familiar with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, if you could just maybe give us a little little information about who and what the Abraham Lincoln Brigade is.
Well, sure. There was a Spanish Civil War when a little political stuff here. The the fascists were trying to take over, and there are people who, in Spain in particular, who there were what's called the international brigades. People from all over the world went to Spain to try to fight off fascism, and the Abraham Lincoln Brigade was the American contingency, and they went there to, you know, to fight for democracy there, and they were really an amazing group of people. There's really just a handful of them still alive now, but they, you know, all it wasn't just a phase. I find them very inspiring because they were people that when they were very young, they had these beliefs and these ideals, and it wasn't just a phase. They stayed very politically active, you know, supporting all the, you know, the different things, the lefty things. I'm a lefty, and you know, and all throughout their lives, still, you know, like supporting Cuba and supporting, you know, like aid to Cuba during this really lengthy embargo against them, and all these different things that to the last, you know, you have people in their 90s and they're still just so much for, you know, the people and not the people versus, you know, corporate rule and that sort of thing all the way down. So there's maybe like four of them left now. Bunch of them died just in the past few years. But there was a bigger group. A lot of them were blacklisted. But there's all kinds of, they're just incredible people, and there's all kinds of writings, books, poetry, and incredibly beautiful music. And so that's where I come in and get to share that history. I didn't know anything about them until I was first invited to perform back in the early 2000s. That's the first time I ever, because they're not taught in school, but they're really great people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember I went to one of their yearly sort of gatherings and celebrations of the work. I think it must have been in the 90s, and I'm not certain if Mukana Mwetu, choir that I sang with at that time, anti-apartheid choir,
mm-hmm.
was the reason why I knew about it. And,
mm-hmm.
and I believe Alice Walker was speaking at that particular event, you know, honoring the veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
So it's
great to hear. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, Paul Robeson was also part of, you know, that, and so one of the pieces Michael Sullivan directed Peter Callender in the role of Paul Robeson at one of the Lincoln Brigade events.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, that's great. That's really great. I bet that was nice.
Yeah.
Wow, that is really awesome. Well, you are busy. Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us, Belina. And again, you know, have a wonderful closing weekend at the Theater Rhinos production of Shirlene Holmes, A Lady and a Woman, at the Eureka Theater in San Francisco tonight.
Well, thank you, Wanda.
Afternoon. Oh, you're quite welcome. It's been really lovely speaking to you.
Appreciate it. Appreciate your shining light on this.
Oh, well, hey. I'm really happy to have the type of, I guess, resources that can do that. You know, we had Shirlene on before you opened, and now we have you on as the run closes. So it's perfect bookending, you know.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Have a great rest of the day.
You too.
Tonight. Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So I want to also let our audience know, meant to mention it earlier on before the show started, but got kind of distracted. So I'm not certain if the rally is still happening, but it started at 8:30, and it's at the California State Building, 3350 McAllister Street in San Francisco. and formerly incarcerated people and prisoner advocates are voicing their urgent concerns about ongoing prison crowding at a conference being organized by UC Hastings College of the Law on California's notorious prison system. The conference is called Correctional Crisis, Realignment, and Reform Symposium, and it lists more than two dozen speakers, many working with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, CDCR. And we put quotation marks around that rehabilitation word because no one is being rehabilitated, particularly with the overcrowding and the blatant inattention to the needs of the population, the prisoner population around health care and around true rehabilitation, whether that's education or other types of training that can help people change their lives. Education around health and well-being as well, being a part of the rehabilitation process. So elected officials, academics, CDCR officials, criminologists, and law enforcement are discussing, as we speak, various state and county responses to the systemic changes in California prison system since 2009. And since former prisoners and prisoner advocates are not well represented on the symposium's panels, they will. The rally is happening outside to call attention, or the rally happened outside to call attention to the deteriorating conditions and ongoing health crisis women and transgender prisoners are facing inside California's prisons, amid claims by CDCR that the crisis has been resolved. I don't know if you all remember the hunger strikes, which began about, I think it's been 2 years now. It feels like 2 years since they started and then stopped and then started again because the demands were not met. And I was at Central California Women's Facility just last week and met with two women who had both tried to commit suicide because their mental health and physical health care needs were not being met. And so it's crazy that someone would have to almost try to kill themselves to be able to get the type of care they need so that they can be healthy. A person is in prison, but they're still human beings, they're still citizens, even if on paper they've been denied those particular rights because constitutionally once one is incarcerated, one is no longer a citizen, which some people translate as then we can do with you what we want to do with you, but not as long as there are people outside, like California Coalition Women Prisoners, All of Us Are None, and other activists who are not going to let these voices remain silent. So this particular rally, which I believe is probably over, but I'm not certain because I'm not there in the studio, is a good thing. And we definitely never need to forget what's going on behind the walls, the prison walls, and advocate and voice and lift up the voices of those inside so that they will receive the type of health care and that they deserve, and also that people that are serving these ridiculously long sentences that have been found eligible for release are released. So anyway, if you're interested in finding out more, you can look up California's United for Responsible Budget. You can call area code 510-517-6612 and ask for Isaac Ontiveros, who is the person who is like the point person on this rally that I'm reading the press release of. So I'm going to close the show with another reminder. I was actually going to play an interview that I had with Jackie Jones, who is the producer and director of the film 100 80 days a year inside an American high school that's going to be airing Monday and Tuesday, March 25th and 26th at 9 p.m. As a part of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative addressing high school dropout rates. So this is a four-hour film that's airing from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday, March 25th, and Tuesday, March 26th on PBS. So if it's airing 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time, that means it's airing a little earlier for us. So you just check the PBS schedule to make sure that you don't miss this really moving and well-presented piece on a public school called D.C. Met, which is in our state capital, and the film follows five students, Raven Costin, who is 17, Raven Quattlebaum, who's 18, Rufus McDowney, who's 16, Tierra Parker, who's 18, and Delonte Bennett, who is 18. And these children, you know, besides, you know, having having multiple crises, you know, some, most of them beyond their control because they're children, all of them, financial crisis being sort of the normative for the children that are in this school. And Principal Tanisha Williams Minor and the faculty that we meet as well in this film just show how much, you know, the wealth of it, that we have in adults who care about these children, and the imbalance between this wealth in the administrators and faculty that are trying to teach children, and the ones we're meeting in D.C. Met, and the absence of district support for the type of work they're doing, absence as well as not even really knowing the specifics around what is going on in the schools, particularly the things that are working, and giving resources to these administrators and teachers so that they could do what they have to do without having to pinch, you know, be creative in the financing to the point of even maybe even going in pocket to do the kind of things that they do, which should be something that, you know, we think about the education of our children and they are our future, then money should not be an object, but it is. And these children do not have access to the type of resources that more affluent districts have. So, you know, that they have music and that they have, you know, a basketball team and a cheerleading team. And I didn't see visual arts, but maybe they have a visual arts program. And then these resources are ones that are not stable, which means that every year when the end of the year comes around, like, what's going to get cut? Are we going to have to cut the music? Are we going to have to cut, you know, these other particular core curriculum? Because I believe that art is core. It's just ridiculous. It should not be on the chopping table. It should not be a negotiable, because art is what makes us human. So anyway, enough. I just want to make sure that everyone checks out 180 Days a Year Inside an American High School and listen to the wonderful interview we had with Jackie Jones on Wednesday. It was an extended interview, and it was really provocative and profound quite informative. So we're going to close with James Brown on Black Women, and it's a really wonderful piece. As we're talking about the Black woman is God. So here we go.
I'm a woman. I'm a woman. I'm a woman. I'm a woman. Wake up inside.
learned to fail. And when he can't win, he thinks he's in jail. Tell me, say it again, say it again. What makes men jealous of each other? Against his brother. Now here's the reason. She makes a cloudy day seem bright. She makes a nightmare turn into the warmest night. You know, she makes trouble seem so soft. She can turn to hardship, and she makes it so easy to cross. She brings life into the world over and over again. No man in the world would ever bear those things. She never lets you know when she feels bad, and she smiles when she feels sad. And when you feel blue, she knows her place right beside you, right beside you. And I wanna know, what makes men stop tiring? And who's the only one can stop a baby from crying? The supreme being will always beat you and I sin. Supreme being will always beat you in our sin, because he knows he made you only, so he decided
Repertory Group Theater to to see the Dr. C's two pieces, Tituba, Black Witch of Salem, as well as Nat, which is the story of Nat Turner, and that's going to be really great. And then the Bessie Coleman piece is also running at the Black Rep tonight, tomorrow, and I believe there's a performance before the Tituba piece earlier in the afternoon, because Tituba is at 8 o'clock in the evening. So you can visit the Black Repertory Group Theater on the web to get the specifics. But I had an interview with the playwright on Wednesday as well. He followed the interview with Jackie Jones. So really, really great show, and I encourage everyone to watch it and listen to it. And I'm thinking, I think I'll just play however much will fit into the remaining time that we have on the air in the archives. So I'm just going to play it until it plays out. So hopefully we'll get to Dr. C. But if not, again, it's rebroadcast from Wednesday's show, which was the first day of spring. So happy spring, everyone. Hope you're enjoying this great day, and definitely, you know, we need to keep the revolutionary edge going all the time. Can't forget, because when we forget and when we think everything is everything and everything is groovy, that's when, and we let our guards down, that's when we lose distance and we lose our place in the stride forward. So peace and blessings, everyone, and listen to this great interview and check out Wanda's picks for anything that I didn't remember to tell you about what's going on in the Bay Area. And I update it periodically, so you should check back. Peace and blessings. Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And we open with Robert Glasper's Butterfly from Double Booked. And I thought it would be a great sort of theme for this conversation that we're going to be having with Jackie Jones, who is the director and producer of a new film about the crisis in American schools called 180 Days, A Year Inside an American High School, which is airing on Monday and Tuesday, March 25th and 26th, just next week, at 9 o'clock on public broadcasting stations. Welcome to the show, Jackie. Good morning.
Good morning, Wanda.
Great to have you with us. And this film is this insider look is just, wow, people are going to just be really appalled and shocked to see what our tax dollars are not doing, how they're not, you know, being used successfully, to, you know, to reach a lot of poor students and, you know, students that represent the norm throughout our country. But these particular students are a part of Washington Metropolitan High School, or DC Met. And we were talking before we went on the air how this particular school is within a stone's throw, literally, of the Capitol.
Indeed it is. It's you can see right down North Capitol to the actual Capitol. So it is kind of shocking that a school so close is so under-resourced. But I have to say that there are a lot of challenges that the school has, and the kids especially have. But I think the other thing about the film that's important to note is that it also shows how really heroic so many of the teachers are. I think we've heard so much lately about bad teachers and how teaching is really the problem in our schools. And I think what we found, like, you know, living and breathing the story for a year, is that the teachers do, I mean, above and beyond the call of duty. The issue really is about how resources are allocated and how we as a society also allow the schools to bear the brunt of so many things that are wrong in our society. I mean, kids can look around and see what's really valued in our society today, and it's not education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading some of the program notes. Says Washington, D.C. became the school reform movement's ground zero in 2007 when Michelle Rhee, is it Rhee or Ray?
Rhee.
Became school's chancellor. Test scores rose and fell, and now the nation's capital tops the list of major U.S. cities for its glaring achievement gap. White students best black students by a margin of as much as 4-1. The United States ranks near the bottom of all indexes for education among industrialized nations, and most African-American children now attend schools in which graduation is not the norm. School reform has brought numerous changes and has emphasized standardized testing, partially promoted by the Obama administration's Race to the Top initiative, in which school funding and personnel decisions are based largely on the results of high-stakes standardized tests. Tests, however, don't take into account the troubled population of the school at the center of the documentary, Washington Metropolitan High School, a school for children at risk of dropping out. It doesn't measure the effect that a parent is dying or baby coming or a displacement by Hurricane Katrina or drug-addicted parents or the foster care system have on a student's ability to succeed or even show up for school. And it doesn't measure the desperate efforts of a school faculty working to reach these children. So maybe we could talk a little bit about the film, and then I'll introduce you properly by reading your bio. But maybe you could tell us about the five children that you follow, and these great teachers led by a wonderful principal.
Well, the kids, I mean, you know, people have asked us a lot, how do we choose these kids and why these five kids? And the truth is we started out with more than five kids. Mm. And we were really looking for kids who kind of volunteered. I mean, several kids really wanted to be in the film. And as we went through the year, other characters emerged just based on what was happening in their lives. And so we ended up with the five really amazing kids. And the reason that I say they're amazing is not because they're going through a lot, but because they were incredibly eloquent about their own experiences. I think particularly like with the teen mom that we focus on, who was displaced by Hurricane Katrina and, you know, spent her early teen years just moving from place to place as her mother was sort of trying to recover both emotionally and economically from that devastating hurricane. What you hear her saying, you know, is that she's aware that, you know, she's trying to fill this loss with something. And the thing that she really comes up with to fill it with is this baby. So it's not the kind of thing that I think people throw out there where, you know, young women are just careless about birth control or they just, you know, don't care about becoming team mothers. It was an actual intentional choice that she made to fill a void. And I think when you hear from the kids and you really hear them talk about not the challenges from a day-to-day standpoint, but the challenges as human beings, the anger and the hurt and the insecurity and the fear that really go hand in hand with poverty that we just overlook. And I think that is the challenge of teachers and school leaders who are really trying to reengage the kids in their learning and expose the kids to a different set of opportunities than what they're aware of.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And another what I really liked about your following Raven is, you know, her baby is just so beautiful.
Right.
She's in all these different programs to sort of help her be a better mother. And the child's father is also in her life.
Right.
And, you know, you show them, you know, at the graduation, and she's one of the only young mothers there that has the father as well.
Right.
Which is really great.
I know.
And
it's really, I mean, when you see the two of them also trying to figure out their relationship and how do we do this. And, I mean, you know, I think it really dispels a lot of myths about teen parents. She's very committed to breaking the cycle. You know, she herself doesn't have the knowledge to do that, but she's looking for every possible person that can mentor her and help her because she knows that she's trapped in that and she's trying to work to get out. I mean, when you think about her as a 17-year-old getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, getting that baby ready for daycare, then getting herself to school, and then going to a part-time job to help out not only with her expenses with the baby, but with her family's expenses. When you see all of that happening, and then you think to yourself, how am I going to be studying for my Algebra 2 test? You know, how am I going to spend the time that I need to focus on my academics? And there's nothing that one teacher can do that can turn all that around.
Right, yeah. And then when she takes the baby for her checkup and shots, she asked the doctor for a note for school. She says, oh, you're missing school, you know, with a surprise in her voice.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, wow, yeah, I'm a teenager that's actually in high school. Yeah, I thought I liked that particular scene. And hadn't realized that there were two Ravens in the other Raven story.
Right.
You know, she's a really amazing. When she talks about why she used to rob people, because she was just feeling so bad, and you know, she's in a foster care the foster care system, and when she talks about how far she has to travel, I mean, you know, in the latest place that she's at is nowhere near the school.
Right.
And how she has to travel so far and how she decided to transform her life and stop robbing people, and just because she needed to do something with that energy because she was so
right.
upset. It's like, wow, I never, you know, sort of got on the inside of the person who was doing the criminal behavior, like what's motivating them.
Right.
It's not
right.
that
I mean,
need the money or I need the whatever. It's like I got to do something with this pain that I'm experiencing. So I'm going to hurt you because I'm hurting and I can't do anything about it because I'm not in control, perhaps.
And I think, you know, the scene in Raven's story that always just gets me is the scene where she's in her room, and you see that whole memorial wall that she has to all
yes.
of her friends that have been killed.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly that one, there's a T-shirt on the wall that has rest in peace and the names of at least 10 kids.
Right.
And those kids were all killed, probably by other kids, in one school year at one school.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about, I mean, just the psychic pain of that, and trauma,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, that has to go somewhere. And I think those are the things that we need to sort of take into account as a society. I don't think it's something that should only be placed at the foot of a school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And And the boys, you know, their stories are really something too. Particularly the child, I think it's Rufus, who whose mother dies, and I'm not quite clear if anybody's living in that house with he and his brother, or are they by themselves? Because he talks about how when his mother was dying, as I think she had cancer, you know, she encouraged them, and other people would come over the house and sort of help out. And then when she was gone, all that assistance evaporated. So I'm wondering, like, who are their support persons?
Well, that is actually Delonte. They're two boys
in the film. Oh,
that's
Delonte? Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're two boys in the film who lose their mothers. And actually, over the 2 years that we were basically in the school, the first year doing pre-production and doing, you know, just getting to understand the school community, over those 2 years, at least a dozen kids lost parents. And I think that's another thing that we don't really think about when we think about poverty is that, you know, when both of them lost their mother to cancer, one to breast cancer, one to lung cancer, and just the nature of being poor and getting health care, by the time you go in for whatever it is that's bothering you, it's already at a stage four. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these are young people. Their parents are probably in their late 30s, early 40s at the most, that are dying of cancer. And in the case of Delonte, it is a house full of kids. I mean, the oldest person, the person that assumed guardianship, was 21 years old. You know, and in the case of Rufus, who also lost his mother, he, you know, their family got evicted the next day. Not the next day, but the following week, because I guess that had already been in process. And then his father wasn't employed, and there was no way to stop it. And he ends up, you know, living with a cousin who, I don't want to give this part away, but you know what I mean, sort of disrupts his life even more, not intentionally, but disrupts his life even more. So it's that whole, you know, like insecurity and instability that kids are living with by virtue of being born poor, frankly, you know. But I also don't, I mean, it's also not, you know, 4 hours of like sad stories about being poor.
No, it's not.
There's also a lot of really, really inspirational things that happen and really wonderful things that happen throughout the course of the year.
Yeah, and that's often the case. You know, children show up. You know, we start on the first day of school. We get the pep talk, you know, in the staff room, you know, where the principal, Tanisha Williams-Viner, is letting the faculty know about the new laws and the you know, how many students they have coming in and how many they need, how many more they need, you know, in order to get all the funding and so that they can all stay employed for that the school year. And yeah, she's great. I love the staff sessions, particularly the one with the eggs. You know, she's you know, demonstrating how the faculty need to support each other and help each other, help the students.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah,
too.
That's a great one. Yeah, and then I love it when you know, all the hugs and shaking hands with the kids and the cheerleading moves. That's like, wow, look at the principal. The cheer, like, oh, look at her. Like, wow.
And that's after a whole day of doing what she does, you know. So we don't know how she has the energy to do what she does. She's still like an energizer bunny to this day. So we're all amazed by her. But also the fact that we were did a panel discussion in D.C. last night with some kids.
Oh.
And one of the things that the kids say, and you hear it a lot like from kids, is that, you know, we want to be somewhere where we feel like we're loved. You know, and I think that's the thing that just radiates from Tanisha, is that she really loves those kids, you know, and she has the highest expectations of them, even when they're doing the wrong thing or making bad choices. They're kids, you know what I mean? And kids do that. they make bad choices. So you got to love them anyway. I mean, every parent knows that.
Like, right.
You don't stop loving your kid because they do something stupid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the school, you know, that, you know, under her leadership, you know, that's been created, DC Met, is certainly a place where children can come and be successful, and the teachers and the support faculty and staff, because Coach talks about how, you know, everyone is a teacher. I just love, you know, his sessions with, you know, his when he talks about, you know, he's the coach. And there's only one. Is that Gary Barnes? No, that's Jonathan Smith, right? Gary Barnes, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Jonathan, yeah, he's great. And then, you know, talk about his prior career as a, he worked in corrections. I'm like, whoa, that's amazing. And talking about his background, and then Jonathan Smith, you know, the first year teacher, he's like 23. I'm like, he is heavy young. He is like, whoa. And then, yeah, he's like not much, I mean, there's not much time separating him from his students, because the students, you know, are older teenagers. I mean, you know, 17, 18. So
right.
He's 23. He could be their big brother.
Exactly. I know.
Yeah, it's really great. So now let me introduce you properly, and we can talk about how you all did this, because you tell me, you know, I'm not working alone. I have a team. So Jackie Jones is the executive director of the National Black Programming Consortium, NBPC, and the executive producer of DC Met. Since taking over leadership of NBPC, Jackie has established herself as a leader in the evolving next media landscape through innovative partnerships and initiatives such as the Katrina Project, the groundbreaking New Media Institute, the Public Media Corps, and blackpublicmedia.org. She was previously the executive vice president of Roja, R-O-J-A,
mm-hmm.
Productions in New York City, a producer of high-impact media for public television and museums. Jackie is also a Peabody Award-winning producer and director of documentary films. Which ones?
Africans in America was the film I won a Peabody for. Mm-hmm. It was a four-part series about slavery in America.
Mm-hmm.
Matters of Race is another film series that I've senior produced. I've also produced a couple of films for other non-PBS entities like Showtime and History Channel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was that the Behind Closed Doors, Sex in the 20th Century?
That, right. That was
The World
for
Before
Showtime.
Us. Mm-hmm.
That was for, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So The World Before Us, what's that about?
That was a series of short films that were about, like, seminal moments in world history.
Mm-hmm.
So they looked at all kinds of things, from the election of Kwame Nkrumah as the first black, you know, independence president, to the libraries of Timbuktu, to Josephine Baker's intervention in World War II as a spy for the French, to the Hungarian Revolution. It was like all over the world. It was actually probably the most exciting project I did, just by virtue of being able to travel to all those places, many of which I would have never gone to,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a tourist like Hungary.
Yeah,
so
wow.
It was cool. It was very
yeah.
cool.
So you were in Timbuktu?
I went to Timbuktu, yeah.
Nice,
yeah.
Yeah. How long ago was that?
That was about maybe a little over 10 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, awesome. You probably, when you reflect on what's happening in northern Mali now.
I know, it's terrible. It's
really sad
that there's so much of those traditional structures have been lost. And I mean, it was amazing. I had never been, you know, really in a desert like that before. And to see, like, the Tuareg people literally come in the morning, and like a long train of camels in their robes, and, you know, and then leave as the sun goes down. It was pretty amazing and dramatic. And then those thousands of year old structures, I mean, it is really hot in Timbuktu. Like, you can't do anything during the middle of the day because it's like 120 degrees. But inside of those structures is completely cool,
mm-hmm.
naturally, because of the way that they're made by, you know, with mud and no windows. And so you go in there and it's like air conditioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and isn't it really cool the way there's rice mixed in with the mud? And so
mm-hmm.
in the old, and you know, you see the rice sort of coming out, and you see piles of rice inside
mm-hmm.
of the structures. And just I just sort of think about Usman Sembin's films, right? And
mm-hmm.
he, you know, in some of them you see these structures that sort of remind you of the anthills.
Right.
In the architecture, and it's like, whoa.
Right.
Yeah. It was really neat. I was there for the a music festival.
That must have been cool.
Yeah, it was neat. And you're right. It's like I don't think I could live in the desert like all the time. That's like serious. Like, how do you stay clean? How do you keep the sand out of your face and nose when you go to sleep? Like, and I actually camped out. I slept in a tent. So
wow.
Yeah, it was pretty adventurous, but it was fun. Yeah, and you have a BA in English from Howard University and an MA from Stanford University. Stanford University's documentary filmmaking program, which is renowned, and you've been a Revson Fellow at Columbia University and a scholar in residence at American University in Washington, D.C., and you currently serve as vice chair of the Integrated Media Association Board and on the Community Advisory Board of WHUT Howard University Television. And as I was looking at some of the, you know, some of the planning clips, you all engage young people in the whole idea of this initiative, which, what is it called, is a part of the American Graduate.
I
Am the Light. Yeah, yes. And so in New York, there is this school, and this young people, and what they're studying is advertising. And
mm-hmm.
that clip was really interesting, particularly the person who talked about finding them. So I wonder if you could talk about how you all pulled this wonderful series together and who your partners are in the film.
Well, we have a lot of partners in the film, starting with PBS, of course, and all of the PBS stations. We've partnered with 23, I think, stations around the country to do to take a deeper dive around the issues, particularly with young people and surfacing young people's voices as filmmakers and storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
So we launched, as part of the rollout to 180 Days, the American Graduate Student Film Festival, which is online. People
mm-hmm.
should go there and vote for their favorite film.
Okay.
And there were over 33 films from all over the country, including Native American reservations and New Orleans, Philly, I mean, just everywhere, with people talking about really, really different issues, Mississippi
mm-hmm.
And other parts of the South. So I really encourage people to check that out. And then through the TED Talks, you know, are you familiar with TED? And well, TED is an annual convening of thinkers and practitioners around sort of social justice issues, but through a really progressive lens. So, I mean, you could approach it from a micro-lending standpoint. You could address it from a content production standpoint. Just people who are thinking out the box of how do we solve some of the problems that we see around us. And then they started doing these little satellite things called TEDxs, where they get together just real innovators from communities and spend a day just throwing out ideas. So people talk for no more than 3 minutes, but they just throw out idea after idea after idea. So they did one of these in Harlem, and our office is located in Harlem. They did a TEDx at the Riverside Church. And very famous and very wonderful place. One of the talks was about this high school in Brooklyn called IAM, which is the Institute for Advanced Media Studies.
Yeah.
And the the whole idea of the high school was that it's partnered with an advertising trade organization, and the advertising trade organization called the 4A's gets like real advertising executives to teach and mentor the kids. So when they were doing their TEDx, they were saying that they were launching an actual advertising agency inside their school that would be totally run by students. So we thought, you know, we have to partner with these guys because we really, I mean, part of the whole idea behind the film is we've heard so much from experts and Michelle Rhee and Bill Gates and, you know, everybody else, Arne Duncan, President Obama, about what's wrong with public schools and how we're going to fix public schools, but who we haven't heard from is the kids. So we thought, like, who better to help us, you know, really amplify the voices of the kids than other kids? So we started working with them probably about 6 months ago, and they came up with a campaign called I Am the Light to have people basically upload videos saying what they think are solutions to the problems that they see. And their goal is to get 1.2 million people to log on to the campaign in any way through Twitter, Instagram, or you can actually upload a video online. And the 1.2 million figure represents the number of kids who drop out every year. And when I checked last night, they were up to 550,000. So they are almost halfway there, and I encourage your listeners to help them get there.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. That's one another thing that's really great about the film is the reality checks that happen with regards to the statistics. And the principal also, like when she talks to the ninth graders, the entering ninth graders, you know, telling them that how important ninth grade is and the statistics around who graduates. Okay, she says, look to your left, look to your right, you know. Insofar as, you know, how those, you know, one of them is probably not going to continue and graduate, you know, 4 years down the road. And then the excitement, you know, juxtaposing that with the excitement of their first graduating class.
Right.
Yeah, which is was in 2012.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So tell us, you know, what the principal's backstory is. How, you know, and she tells us, you know, sort of how she came to the position. But it was more circuitous the way she ended up as principal of this you know, wonderful and sort of innovative high school.
Well, we met her when she was a principal of another high school called Spingarn. And she was really focused on a program that was for adult learners, like older teenagers and young adults that had been disengaged from school for one reason or another. And I think I can't really speak for her, but I've spent a lot of time around her, so I will speak for her anyway. I think that, you know, her real passion is re-engaging learners who have become disengaged. Because the reality of the dropout thing is that, you know, you don't go to school every day and make good grades and then wake up one day and drop out. It's a real process of disengagement that goes over time. In that panel discussion I was just mentioning that we had last night, there was a student there who said that he had not gone to school for 26 days. He just didn't go to school. And nobody noticed. Nobody called him, nobody called his mom, nobody sent a letter. You know, they just kept marking him absent for 26 days. Mm-hmm. And that is something that could never happen at any school that Tanisha Williams Minor is the principal of. I mean, they would go and find that kid and drag him out of bed back to school if they had to, because they really believe that every kid, you know, has the capacity to overcome whatever they're dealing with as long as they have support. And I think that's really why we chose that school, is because of her vision about reengaging disengaged kids and her passion and her love of the kids. I think it's something you just don't see enough of when we talk about education. It's about test scores and money and, you know, privatization. It's not about the fact that most people enter that field because they love kids and they want to help kids. And we as a society need to help them help the kids more than we are.
Or I know we're sort of out of my time. Do you have a few more minutes? I have a couple more questions. Okay, super. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, some of the teachers you profile. You know, I mentioned the first year teacher who is who teaches science, and he is just so great. And it seems as if he has a mentor teacher, a more experienced teacher to work with him. And I think, you know, sort of following his process of taking what he knows, because he's brilliant, you know, and translating that into the information that the student need in order to matriculate and move through, you know, the educational system is really great to watch, particularly, you know, when he's successful at this translation and the kids are all happy and they're really engaged and mystified and excited about science.
Right. Well, I think this is one of the great things about DC public schools that I think people don't know. And I'm a parent of a child, and I didn't know that. You know, that there's this part of, you know, part of this linking of test scores to teachers, like making teachers accountable for the test scores, there is a whole very formal evaluation process that goes along with that, and it involves this mentoring. So schools now have these instructional coaches, and that's what they do. They help teachers teach better. So a new teacher like Smythe would have like a regular series of one-on-one interactions with this coach who, you know, is just very, very experienced and obviously fantastic at what she does. So it really, I mean, the teachers are really supported in ways I think that we also don't see. I think, you know, I mean, one of our issues with this film is that we really tried to get DCPS on board to say, you know, this is not an expose about what's wrong with DCPS. This is about teaching and learning in this one building. But I think that there haven't been enough stories that really say that there are some things that these school systems, even embattled ones like DC, are getting right. And I think that whole instructional coach thing is one of the things that DCPS is absolutely getting right.
And then talk about the in-school suspension coordinator and basketball coach. He's great.
He's a character.
Yeah, Barnes.
He's such a character. He's like our soundbite guy. He like has so many great quotes. We wanted to do like, you know, those magic eight balls where you shake it and a saying comes out. We wanted to do one with all his great Barnes-isms. But, I mean, he was, like, our kind of keeping it real character because he had, you know, he had a lot of experience with the criminal justice system. And, you know, he said, like, he knew a lot of these kids' parents when they were in jail. So he was very real about, like, what they were up against and really, you know, organically a part of that community. So, you know, and he didn't really have anything to lose. You know, unlike the teachers, I think, and even the principal, who, you know, are really trying to follow the rules because these are their careers, you know, and even though they want to do the best job they can, they also know that there's certain parameters that they, you know, they cross that and they're out. Whereas Barnes, I think he just said whatever, you know, thought. And so we get a lot of wisdom from him and a lot of just, you know, reality checks. It's like if you come to high school, and you can't read, then that's a problem. You know what I mean? We hear it again at the end of the film from Smythe, but it's like, how are you going to learn physics in high school if you can't read? You know, and why are you even showing up in high school if you can't read? You've been to school for 8 years. Somebody should have noticed that you can't read. And those are the kind of issues that a school like this has to deal with. And then they become responsible for teaching that kid how to read and teaching them everything they need to know to progress through high school.
It's really, really wonderful, you know, to not experience just a day in the life, but a lot of days, like a whole school year in the lives of, you know, this institution, and how the institution is not just within those walls, that is outside as well, because, you know, wherever those children are, that's where it goes. I mean, because you think about Head Start, and in Head Start, one of the innovations about that particular program for school, you know, children was that they had parenting education, and the teachers would go out in the community to these places where the children live, and you see teachers going to knock on doors where these children live, like, oh, that's nice. Yeah, because all schools are not necessarily going and trying to rescue children that they don't see anymore. Because there are a whole lot of schools that just check the kid off and don't ever wonder what happened to them. And try
right.
to, because sometimes children, they don't have phones in the house, and so you can't call and see where they are. You've got to actually go make that home visit.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think it's funny.